Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. More than 5,200 Pennsylvanians died of drug overdoses in 2017. That's an increase of more than 600 from the year before. Heroin and opioid overdoses have reached epidemic proportions.
To further combat this crisis, today I'm issuing a statewide disaster declaration for the heroin and opioid epidemic. And officially, I am declaring this public health crisis a statewide disaster emergency.
That's Governor Tom Wolf taking an unprecedented step in Pennsylvania's history to deal with a public health emergency. So what will this emergency disaster declaration do, and how will it help fight the heroin and opioid crisis? Joining us for the first few minutes of today's program is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Policy and Planning, Sarah Gabali. Secretary Gabali, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
This has never happened before in Pennsylvania's history. As I said, this is unprecedented. And we all know that the opioid and heroin crisis is getting worse. But why did Governor Wolf decide to take this step?
So the governor has been working essentially since he came into office on how to tackle this epidemic and has implemented a series of policy changes. He's worked with the General Assembly to get funding into treatment and to expand access to naloxone. But as we know, the epidemic continues to get worse. And so this is another opportunity for the governor and members of his cabinet to have additional tools in their toolbox to further address the epidemic.
Those tools, there are 13 initiatives broken down into three areas. What are a few of the most important without listing all 13?
Yeah, so first, with the signing of the disaster declaration, the governor has formed an opioid operational command center headquartered at the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency. And basically what we will do is we are going to bring together about 10 of the agencies under the governor's jurisdiction and have them work in a more coordinated fashion using emergency management techniques to make sure that we are appropriately addressing the epidemic both at the state level but also working with local and federal governments as well.
Can I just interrupt for 1 second?
Yeah, of course.
When you say using emergency management techniques, what specifically does that mean?
Yeah, so again, like since the governor has come into office, his secretaries have been working, members of his cabinet have been working to address the epidemic, and there has been an informal work group mainly made up of the Health and Human Service secretaries who meet about every other week to continuously brainstorm additional ideas that we can do to address the epidemic. Moving that work group and adding some other agencies to PEMA will allow us to use the tools that they use in a traditional weather emergency or some type of other emergency. So basically, kind of daily running through a checklist of what's going on, making sure that we are putting all data that we're collecting across agencies into one place to kind of inform where in the state we are having flare-ups, but also to make sure that we're using that data to inform future policy decisions. So it'll be a bit more organized in terms of a checklist of who's doing what, where we're getting information, and how we can better respond.
I noticed, and I'm going to talk more about some of those other initiatives in just a few minutes, but I noticed with the initiatives that they are in response to the epidemic rather than getting ahead of it. The word emergency sometimes brings with it images of putting out a fire. Is that where we are now, that we just have to put out this fire?
So, again, these are additional tools in the governor's toolbox. I think to fully put out the fire, we need to continue to work with the General Assembly to make sure that we are getting additional legislative changes that will allow us to go further in terms of restricting the number of opioids that can be prescribed to a patient at any point in time. and additional changes that will help us kind of stem the flow into addiction. But this is going to help us address those who are currently suffering from addiction. It will help us get more individuals into treatment by breaking down some of the barriers that they currently have, getting additional information at the state level so, again, we can develop better policy solutions and redirect resources where necessary and improve agency coordination.
As you just said, it will take some legislative action and probably actions through other agencies and other people across the state. But at this point, is it accurate to say that we're not getting ahead of this? I mean, when I just read that figure of 600 more overdose deaths in 2017 than 2016, this seems like it's very difficult to get ahead of.
It is definitely a very challenging epidemic to get ahead of. I do think that we are making progress. For example, the prescription drug monitoring database that was launched or relaunched in August of 2016, we, as a result of that tool, we've seen a decrease in the number of opioids that are being prescribed. So I do think that there are places where we are seeing progress in terms of stemming addiction. Obviously, there are a lot of residents across Pennsylvania who are suffering, and we need to get them into treatment.
So let's go talk about a few of the other initiatives. One that really kind of stuck out to me was allowing EMTs to leave behind a dose of naloxone. Now, for those that don't know, although it's been talked about a lot in the last few years, naloxone is something that can bring someone back from the dead, overdose victims, to help them to be restored to life. At this point, many first responders can administer naloxone and have very often and actually save lives. But what this would do would allow them to leave a dose behind. What's the thinking there?
So we know that somebody who has died cannot be treated. So our goal is to make sure that individuals who are receiving transport to a hospital after being revived from an overdose, so that emergency service technician has the ability, if they so choose, to leave naloxone behind with that individual or with their friend or family member. We know that individuals who have been revived from naloxone, that there is a chance that they could OD again within a short period of time as the naloxone wears off. And we also know that when someone is revived with naloxone, that they begin to experience signs of withdrawal and are more likely to use again, increasing their chances of another overdose. So while our goal is to get individuals into treatment and to connect them in a warm handoff process, we also want to make sure that those who refuse that help, that we have another opportunity to touch them at another point in time.
I have to admit, Secretary, that as soon as the governor made his announcement yesterday on social media, I saw some people who were critical of that decision saying, how are you providing motivation to people if you're allowing them to overdose more than once?
I would say that if we first off, I would say that this decision to revise the Physician General Standing Order to allow EMS to leave naloxone behind was not something that we did in a vacuum. It was a practice that was taking place already across the Commonwealth, and this gives them EMS providers the kind of bootstraps they need to do this legally. Secondly, again, going back to the point that we can't help somebody who has died. And so while our primary goal is to get somebody into treatment, we can't force someone into treatment. But we do want to make sure that we have another opportunity to try to get that warm handoff in place and get them into treatment. And so this provides us the time to reengage with those individuals.
Another one of the initiatives is rescheduling all derivatives of fentanyl. We have heard, and I think this is true for outside of even central Pennsylvania, but across the state, that many of the overdoses that we are seeing now that, what used to be considered a heroin overdose, people are using fentanyl, which is much, much more powerful than heroin. So what does rescheduling all derivatives of fentanyl mean?
So rescheduling fentanyl derivatives will mean that our public safety officials across the state have more tools in their tool belt when they come across these derivatives to get them off the street, to make sure that those who are lacing heroin with these derivatives are appropriately held accountable. And it also helps us have a better control over where fentanyl might be legally prescribed in the state.
It is legally prescribed in the state? I mean, I know it's a painkiller.
I would have to go back and check. I know that as we looked at in 2016, legislation was signed by the governor that allows the Secretary of Health to reschedule drugs as necessary. And in looking at other fentanyl derivatives previously, we have done some due diligence around checking to see if and where they are prescribed, maybe relative to, we know that there were maybe some large animal vets that might have prescribed fentanyl in the past and whatnot. And so, again, we just want to make sure that we have an appropriate handle on all of that information.
Let's take a quick phone call from Devin in Lancaster. Devin, you're on the air.
Hi there, Scott.
Hi.
You had mentioned at the beginning of the segment, your question was, how are we really getting ahead of this epidemic? And I work in the field of prevention, and I think it's a recurring question when these announcements come out. We were all eagerly listening from our phones in transit and in our offices yesterday to see if prevention was really going to be a part of this announcement, and it hasn't. So prevention is a science of getting ahead of this epidemic, and there has not been large amounts of money spent in this area. The return on investment for prevention is every dollar spent results in a $17.38 savings on the treatment end. So with new people becoming addicted every day, are we doing the state service with continually putting these Band-Aids on the treatment end, which are critical and necessary, but only can be effective when paired with effective prevention?
Hey, Devin, thank you very much for your call. What about that secretary? I mean, that is not part of the governor's declaration yesterday, but what about other areas for education and prevention?
So this past fall, the governor did sign legislation that creates new prevention initiatives within our K-12 education system so that students will be educated on the risks and dangers associated with opioids and heroin. Additionally, the governor is seeking legislation currently that would, as I referenced before, it would limit the number of opioids that could be prescribed at any point in time, with some exceptions for those who are suffering from cancer and other chronic illnesses. And part of that legislation would also require those who are prescribing, the medical professional, to make sure that they are communicating potential risks and dangers with their patients. So prevention is very important, and again, we continuously seek those types of tools, and we are working with the General Assembly to get some legislation moving in that regard. And the Department of Health and the Department of Education are working in a coordinated fashion to make sure that we are properly educating our youngest residents. Mm.
Secretary, one final question for you. This declaration that the governor made yesterday is for 90 days. That doesn't seem like a long time.
So the way that the disaster declaration is written in statute is that they can last for up to 90 days. Disaster declarations can be reissued. Our goal currently is that we will be using the data and information coming out of the command center to inform our progress as to when and how long this disaster declaration should last.
What does the governor want to see come out of this?
I think the governor, our goal here, the governor's goal here is to make sure that we are breaking down barriers, that we're getting more individuals into treatment, that we are making sure that as a state we are gathering the information to further develop policies to further address this epidemic. And again, this is another set of tools in the state's toolbox to address the epidemic.
Pennsylvania Secretary of Policy and Planning Sarah Gabali. Secretary Gabali, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality.
The cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay affects almost everyone in central Pennsylvania. 35 years into the project, there are some promising signs that the bay is healthier, but still some aspects that remain stubborn. Last week, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation released the Bay Barometer, Health and Restoration in the Chesapeake Bay Watershed 2016-2017. Joining us during this portion of the program is Harry Campbell, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation here in Pennsylvania. Harry, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about the Chesapeake Bay, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I said a question or a comment about the bay. Well, obviously, there's a lot that goes into that than just a question or a comment about the bay itself, but how we here in Pennsylvania have an impact on it. Harry, this isn't the report card where you have given grades in the past, but a barometer on the health of the bay. Just reading over it, it seems to be fairly positive.
Absolutely, Scott. In fact, in this day and age, you know, we hear a lot about the failings of government and the inefficiencies or otherwise failings of those bureaucracies and whatnot. And this is really a tale of success, if you will, a federal, state, and local partnerships actually resulting in real, measurable, long-term improvements in an ecosystem that is 64,000 square miles in size, starting in Cooperstown, New York, flowing all the way down into southern Virginia, draining into the Chesapeake Bay. Water quality, in the form of clarity, is so clear in the Chesapeake Bay, it's, for the past several decades, it hasn't been this clear. Submerged aquatic vegetation, a very important component of the little fisheries and crabs to survive and grow and repopulate, and also to reoxygenate in water, is at near record levels. The dead zones that are in the Chesapeake Bay historically that have been really suffering in terms of the aquatic life, the things that actually have no or little dissolved oxygen in the water, are shrinking and are smaller in size than they've been in years and decades. And pollutants are down, entering into the Chesapeake Bay. So we're seeing a tale of success, this partnership between the federal government, the state government, our local governments, our farmers, our communities, our citizens is working, and we have real, measurable, tangible evidence to demonstrate its success.
Okay, so this barometer, what time period are we talking about?
Well, the snapshot is the 2016-17 timeframe in that regard. But when we start to look at the long-term scenarios, well, we're seeing those trends. And Pennsylvania is an important part of this overall improvement. Now, to say that the bay is anywhere near saved at this juncture would be incorrect. But these improvements at this juncture, this momentum that we're seeing is highly encouraging. The investments in clean water that Pennsylvania and the other Bay states have actually put towards this endeavor for the past several decades are having tangible, real, measurable results. In Pennsylvania, 19 of 23 monitoring stations, long-term monitoring stations within the Susquehanna River Basin, are actually showing long-term, meaningful reductions in the form of nitrogen loads entering into the Chesapeake Bay. Pennsylvania's Watershed Improvement Plan, the things that we're implementing in Pennsylvania to actually reduce pollution in our local rivers and streams and ultimately in the Chesapeake Bay, we're gaining momentum in those things. And we're seeing energy and enthusiasm in our administration, the current administration and the secretaries of the Department of Environmental Protection, Agriculture, and DCNR, Natural Resources, collaborating, coordinating, and strategizing in a way that we haven't seen in decades. So there's a lot of momentum. There's a lot of positivity. But the bay is not saved yet. Now is not the time to distract ourselves.
All right, well, let's talk about that. And I'm going to be talking about some of those other, stubborn areas that where improvements can be made and the bay can be saved in just a few minutes. But last year, we had you on the program when the Trump administration had proposed a budget that would have cut out all funding for Chesapeake Bay restoration. And that, I can't say it's been restored because it was never taken away, but at least the money continues to flow for Chesapeake Bay cleanup. I'm not questioning your findings, but I have to say that it's more positive. And I hate to use the word spin, But there's more positive news since that funding has been threatened than before. I mean, is that a strategy that we have to show that there are some results from this money being spent?
No. It just so happens that the investments from the past several decades, starting in the mid-1980s, are actually maturing or otherwise starting to reverse the trends of pollutant loads that are occurring within the Chesapeake Bay. And once we started really concentrating on this effort in a way that was new and innovative or otherwise a stronger collaboration through the adoption of what is known as the Chesapeake Bay Total Maximum Daily Load,
right. Mm-hmm.
Or the blueprint, which includes
the plants.
That's
what, like 5 years old, something like that?
It's older than that. It's about 7 years old at this juncture. And the implementation plans associated with them are building that momentum from starting in the 1980s when Pennsylvania joined this endeavor. And those results of that implementation over the course of time just so happen to be bearing fruit in the ecosystem. We're seeing a trend. It took decades for the Chesapeake Bay in particular to actually be degraded as it once was. And it'll take decades to restore it. And as a result, that improvement that we've been investing in is starting to bear fruit. We've gone from a degradation cycle to the initiation of a restoration cycle. And it so happens to be occurring at this particular point in time. So those investments that have been made over the course of those decades, we're seeing the fruit in it. And there's no way to sort of the evidence is there in terms of actual real-world monitoring data, not just model data, computer modeling data, crab surveys, aerial photography of submerged aquatic vegetation, actual measurements of water clarity. These are actually showing these improvements. This is real, tangible, and measurable improvements. It just so happens to be coinciding at a time when there was a period where this funding was proposed to be potentially eliminated.
Is there still concern that that money may be eliminated or cut?
Well, there's always concern, certainly, in this regard. We're not talking about a lot of money compared to like the federal budget, if you will. So the Chesapeake Bay Program, which is what we're really talking about in terms of these fundings, is a program of the Environmental Protection Agency. It has received about $70 million over recent budgets in the federal government, and it was proposed to be zeroed out initially. Now, that $70 million does a lot. It's leveraged with state money, with private individual money, with private foundation money, nonprofit monies, and others to essentially result in all these improvements happening on the ground. But that $70 million goes towards collaboration, science, and restoration. And so what that has been able to do is leverage much of what we're seeing these improvements occurring on.
You know, and I, just as an observer, sitting back, I mentioned 35 years, just give or take a year or so, actually started in the early 80s with the Chesapeake Bay program, I guess 1983, but it was discussed even before that. But at one time, this was controversial here in Pennsylvania. I don't know about the other states, because there would be money spent. There would be taxpayer money spent. Now I get the sense that, and it's not just the Wolf administration, but even the administrations, prior administrations for both parties, that this was accepted, that this is accepted here in Pennsylvania, that this is part of what we have to do. I'm pretty sure you would agree with that, but that's, as an observer, has there been an attitude change in the last 10 or 20 years?
Well, I think a number of things are happening. One, certainly the momentum is energizing in terms of the partnership, that seeing these results has re-energized people's enthusiasm for the fact that, quite frankly, we can do this. If we use the tools and information and emerging precision agriculture and other kind of things to really get to the root of the matter, we can do this. But first and foremost, there's a recognition in the science and the engineering, and the information is clearly indicating, we can demonstrate it, that these investments in clean water here in Pennsylvania, sure, we talk about it, the backdrop is the Chesapeake Bay, but first and foremost, they are affecting not only our local rivers and streams in terms of reducing nuisance flooding, improving the sources of drinking water, improving fisheries and recreational opportunities, but then also keeping soils and nutrients on the land in our agricultural settings where they do good instead of in the water where they pollute. And as a result, that means better herd health, lower input costs in terms of the nutrients that you got to apply on the land. And if you're saving soil, you're growing more crops, you're producing more. So the economics of this is actually also been an important part of that. This is important for Pennsylvania. The Chesapeake Bay may be in the backdrop, the driver for many of the conversations, but first and foremost, it's about Pennsylvania, our rivers and streams, our economy, our farmers, our communities.
We're joined now by Allison Prost, who is Interim Vice President of Environmental Protection and Restoration for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Ms. Prost, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I was talking to Harry Campbell just a few minutes ago about this Bay Barometer report having a very positive outlook on it. I'm sure you would agree, but how do you see it overall?
I completely agree that it's positive. It shows that we're seeing progress, but it is not time to step back by any stretch of the imagination. The recovery is fragile, and these results indicate that what we're doing is working. We have to continue it, and in some areas we have to accelerate it if we are going to see this improvement year over year and throughout the Bay watershed.
When you say that this improvement is fragile, what do you mean by that?
You know, we have increased population every year in our watershed. We have more pollution coming in just from the miles that we travel in our cars. It's fragile in that we have to keep all of the new systems in place, all of the best management practices, all of the pollution reductions in place to see this progress continue. The other element that makes it fragile right now is that we are not sure if we have the same level of federal cooperation and leadership that we've had in the past. The Bay cleanup is working because we have a partner in the Environmental Protection Agency that in the past has provided science, resources, research, pulled the different watershed states together to come up with these cleanup plans and efforts. And if that federal partner leaves, whether their resources leave or just the leadership and coordination goes away, I'm not sure the cleanup will continue the same way it has. It's taken years to get this, federal, state, local cooperation in place, and if one of the rungs pulls out, I'm not sure it would continue the way that we've seen that's gotten us these results.
Harry, something that Allison Probst just mentioned, and I wanted to touch on this because this is a big thing. When we say there are still challenges out there, something that she said very briefly is that we can never predict growth and all that. Basically, what we're talking about is runoff. If you get down to it, I mean, depending on where people build, how much impervious surfaces there are, agricultural runoff, all those things. I was looking back through my notes, and in 2013, we had the exact conversation where we were talking about how much of a challenge that urban, suburban, and agricultural runoff is. But that is so unpredictable because you can't forecast where the growth is going to occur. How do you get ahead of this challenge?
Well, first of all, there's a number of ways that you can try to address it, and starting at the source. And it starts even before there's even a thought about breaking ground on a new development, if you will. And that means renders the importance of local community plans, planning to put new developments, redevelopment in the right places. Places that are not sensitive to the ecosystem, like, for instance, in floodplains or alongside streams or wetlands or in areas that may have certain types of topography or vital habitat that is important not only to water quality but to the environment as a whole. So local plans, particularly in Pennsylvania, where we don't have a county-based kind of planning government, if you will, we have those local municipalities, 2,600, over 1,000.
Although there are counties that have planning commissions. Yeah.
Right, they do have planning commissions, but local primacy with the local municipality's rules. And so it starts with a comprehensive plan that looks at where they want growth to occur and where they don't want it to occur, and then zoning accordingly. From there, it requires really thoughtful analysis of the types of development, what it should look like in terms of, how much impervious surface, how wide do the roads really need to be, how big do the parking lots really need to be. We don't need to size a parking lot for the one or two days a year that around Christmas or Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and then have it half empty, quarter full for the rest of the year. So thoughtful ordinances that allow and reduce the amount of impervious surface, the amount of disturbed land, which then reduces the amount of stormwater runoff that is produced in the first place, coupled with smart and green infrastructure-oriented stormwater management ordinances. What is green infrastructure? It basically utilizes nature to try to mimic the hydrologic cycle, meaning it filter, treat, physically remove pollutants and volume and runoff coming off of the landscape, put it back in the ground, back in the air. As far as agriculture, it's really about preserving starting at the source as well, starting with the soils, the soil health, preserving organic matter, preserving soil on the land instead of in the water, and the nutrients associated with it that will result in infiltration, carbon sequestration, improved herd health, and improved water quality across the board.
Pennsylvania obviously plays a great role in this, since the Susquehanna River, as you said, runs from Cooperstown, New York, all the way through the center of Pennsylvania. Allison, I'm curious, what about other states? Do other states, when they are planning for housing development, shopping centers, that kind of thing, how much emphasis do they place on just what Harry described, talking about waterways, wetlands, agriculture, all those things?
Well, I can speak most confidently about Maryland because I also am the Maryland Executive Director here at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. I'm Harry's counterpart in Maryland. But the reality is that all the states are doing that and doing that more. We realize in our urban, suburban sectors that in the past we didn't have this deliberate thinking about how and where we grow. And so part of our urban and suburban cleanup that we need to do is kind of correcting past mistakes where we didn't have the realization of the impact we were having on the environment. Coupled with that is this preventative approach. Let's not repeat that. Let's grow smarter. Let's put development in places that are less sensitive. So both state, you know, throughout the watershed, there are laws about stormwater management. What does a site need to look like when it's all done? What construction practices need to be in place during the development process to prevent additional runoff and impact, you know, while the subdivision shopping center home is being constructed? So it is something that I think all, you know, throughout the watershed is being taken more seriously at the local level, like Harry spoke to, but also there are statewide policies in place that guide how the locals do that. The other thing that is new in terms of the cleanup effort is that as the Chesapeake Bay program and the states are coming together to plan, you know, what needs to happen between 2017 and the, you know, the finish line, so to speak, of 2025, they are actually looking at land use projections. You know, you originally had asked, we can't predict where this growth will happen, and there are actually some pretty good models out there that states and local governments use to say where it makes the most sense, or, you know, you look at the history of development and use that to predict what's coming online. So for the first time in these partnership discussions, there is going to be a recognition of, okay, here are your projections. Here's how land use is going to change in the future. So when you come up with your plans for the cleanup, you need to take that into account. You need to say, okay, this is what we have to do now based on current pollution loads, but we're growing in this particular way, and we need strategies in place to combat that as well. And that, like I said, is the first time in this combined partnership that that discussion is taking place. Certain states, certain municipalities may have done it in the past, but it's a deliberate part of the process now.
Harry, whenever we discuss the Bay, and we talk about it often here on Smart Talk, because, as I said in the introduction, almost everyone in our listening area is impacted in some way by the Chesapeake Bay cleanup and restoration. I always think it's a good idea to provide some, like, a practical description of how these things impact waterways and the Bay. Runoff, in particular, kind of go through the life cycle of, you know, there's soil running off, or there's rain beating down on a parking lot or a highway that has just been built. What happens after that, and how does it impact the waterways and then the Bay?
Well, if you imagine yourself as a water drop coming out of a cloud and coming right down into South Central Pennsylvania.
Sounds like a great cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. You know, hopefully you're a happy little water drop and whatnot, and you're speeding down and you're getting kind of scared and you don't have a parachute. You're hoping to land on, first and foremost, a leaf. That's what you want to land on, because it's going to soften the blow. It's going to slow you down. You're going to then have a nice, slow, and basically comfortable trip down to the soil. And that soil is also going to be pretty fluffy, because that tree has left its leaves on the ground over the course of time, and there's a nice, thick layer of organic matter that's laying on that forest floor. And if you fall there and you have a nice time relaxing there, soon you're going to find yourself going into the ground. You're going to fall, you're going to go a little deeper and deeper and deeper and become part of the deep groundwater wells or groundwater resources that we have in Pennsylvania. If you happen to become the cousin of that water drop and you're falling down into a certain area and all of a sudden you see I'm going to fall on a farm, well, chances are you might be falling on a field. Now, it depends on what kind of field. But let's just say you're going to fall on a field that happens to be corn. Well, you might hit a corn stalk depending on the time of the year or something of that nature, but you're not going to fall in a forest. You're going to fall, and all the leaf material, you're going to fall closer to the ground and be hit a little harder. You might not hit some soil that doesn't have as much organic matter possibly. And as a result, you might erode that soil, because you're going to hit so hard the soil busts, if you will. You also, that soil is not going to have that organic layer so much in it. If it's like a traditional, quote-unquote, type of agricultural setting, not one that we're starting to see changes in with conservation tillage and cover crops and things like that, improvements. And you might run off. You're not going to go in the ground as quickly or as efficiently. And depending on the slope and everything like that, you're going to carry any pollutants that you pick up with it, nutrients, other soil, whatever, is going to latch onto you, and you're going to take it with you to the nearest water body, a river and stream. And that's going to have, deleterious impacts to not only local rivers and streams, but the Chesapeake Bay, because you flow eventually all the way down there, carrying that pollution along the way. If you land on an impervious surface, a rooftop, a parking lot, a highway, or anything of that nature, now you're really in trouble if you're the other cousin of that water drop, because you're going to hit hard and fast. But you're not going to erode any soil, but you're going to have no chance of infiltrating into the ground. So you're going to get quickly shuttled somewhere else. And it may be you're all of a sudden concentrated like in a cattle chute, if you will, on the highway or like you're going in a subway to a pipe that then it goes underground and goes untouched by the natural environment to the nearest water body. So anything you pick up on that impervious surface, whether it be soils like sediment, that's come from various places, nutrients, possibly from lawn fertilizers and things like that, oils, greases, garbage, bacteria from dog feces and everything of that nature, that's going to glom onto you along the way. And if you're not treated through a green infrastructure or something or a tree or something that captures you, you're going to go and carry that right to the nearest water body as well. So once you get into the river, depending on where you are, if you're in Cooperstown area, you got about a month until you hit the Chesapeake Bay. If you're in this area, there's 18 million gallons in the Susquehanna River flowing each day past Harrisburg down towards the Chesapeake Bay. You're going to find your way in a couple of weeks down there, and anything you're carrying with you may ultimately affect the Chesapeake Bay as well as a result. And so if you imagine your water drop, that's your life cycle. That's your story until you go into the ocean and get evaporated and come back and do it all over again.
You sound like you've done that before.
I just made it up.
No, you didn't.
Yes.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're talking about a report released last week by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, the Bay Barometer Health and Restoration in the Chesapeake Bay Watershed 2016-2017. Our guest today, Harry Campbell, Executive Director of Chesapeake Bay Foundation in Pennsylvania. Allison Prost is the Interim Vice President of Environmental Protection and Restoration for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, also Executive Director in the state of Maryland. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729 469-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Allison Probst, Harry and I kind of touched on this a little bit earlier about the improvements that were found in this report. Underwater grasses, blue crab abundance, pollution reduced, and water quality standards achieved. Let's talk about each one of those. Underwater grasses, when we see improvement there, and again, I kind of go back to it's always wise to let everyone know what impact this has on the environment, on the ecosystem of the bay. If we see improvements in underwater grasses, what does that mean?
Well, it means that there is less pollution going in. It means that more sunlight is reaching the bottom, allowing these grasses to grow and thrive. It also means that now we have more of a natural filter back in the water, and our crabs and critters love it because it's their hiding spot from predators. So it is, the underwater grasses abundance is a symbol of the water pollution, the getting better, going away. It's also going to be a catalyst for cleaner water and more critters.
I saw that I mentioned blue crab abundance, that you have seen an increase in the population of blue crabs. Is that a barometer as well, that there are more blue crabs, that means that the bay is healthier? Or is the main consideration there that the crab industry, that people like to eat crabs?
I think that it is both. We cannot have a healthy crab population in the bay long term if we don't have good water quality and we have good management of the fishery. If we lose either one of those, we will see the crab numbers go down. Now, they are going to fluctuate more because weather and other factors contribute to the crab's population, but if we see year over year a trend beginning to form where those crabs are in greater abundance, it means that the water quality is getting better and that the management approach to the fishery is in the right spot. We're saving the right number of females. We're protecting our juveniles because they can hide in these bay grasses now, and people can still enjoy their crabs in the summer.
As far as pollution being reduced, mm-hmm. Even though we just discussed in detail runoff still being an issue, we still are seeing cleaner water, and that kind of goes to water quality standards too.
Right. So we saw this year that 40% of the bay and its tidal tributary, so all the water bodies that feed into the bay, met these water quality standards. So each water body, creek, river, segments of the bay have water quality standards. What needs to be in place to be fishable and swimmable? And we saw that this year, 40% of the bay, which is the highest, 40% of all those water bodies met the water quality standards since they've been looking into it in 1985. So that's great news. We're reaching records. But that still means that 60% throughout the watershed were not meeting water quality standards. So again, it's that we're doing the right thing. We need to do more of it. We can't stop because we're not there yet.
All right, let's take some phone calls. Jody is in Carlisle. Jody, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling to talk about my boys and what I'm teaching them about the watershed. We're in Carlisle, and there's a stream that runs behind our house right in our yard, and we garden and use fertilizers and things, so we're aware of our connection to the Chesapeake Bay. What I tell my boys is that the stream in our house, behind our house, runs into what's called Wirt's Run in Carlisle, and Wirt's Run runs into the Conedogwinet, and the Conedogwinet runs into the Susquehanna, and the Susquehanna runs into the Chesapeake Bay. So there's an immediate connection between what we do in our backyard, what kind of fertilizers we use on the grass and on the garden, and its impact on the Chesapeake Bay. This is the way that I'm trying to educate my kids so that they know what they're doing, what impact they're having, and so we use organic fertilizers and things to do what we can.
Jody, thank you very much for your call. Harry, I'm sure you'd like to hear that from everyone in the region.
Absolutely. And awareness and appreciation of the not only the complexity and the interrelatedness of not only the Chesapeake Bay and this, all the things that Allison was talking about, but also the watershed itself and the small tributaries that ultimately feed into the Susquehanna and Potomac rivers and things like that, really drive home the interconnectedness of this effort, that it takes each and every one of us in terms of our individual decisions every day, where we buy our food, where we live, what we drive, what we purchase in terms of even an energy source, all potentially have an impact, good or bad, on the Chesapeake Bay, but also our local rivers and streams, our local economies, our local quality of life. And so we all have a role to play, depending on who we are, at various different degrees, in preserving, restoring, and protecting this resource that is the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
Let's take another phone call from Jim in Harrisburg. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I got a question. In the 40s and 50s and 60s, the soil conservation put in a lot of strips and contours. Now those farmers have retired or rented their farms out to larger farms, and they also farmed a four or five rotation year, different crops. Okay, they put a lot of hay out, oats, corn, wheat. Today, the big farmer comes in, he plants soybeans and corn, and he does it from the roadway to the bottom of the mountain if he's up in central Pennsylvania or in Lancaster County or wherever. You got all big fields, and soybeans loosen the soil. When we get rain, what do you think happens? How come the soil conservation's revenues has been cut?
Hey, thank you very much for your call. I don't know whether you can answer that, Harry, but what he says, again, as an observer, we do plant a lot of corn and soybean here in central Pennsylvania.
Yes, absolutely. And everybody that does that, every farmer that does it, is required under state law to have a soil conservation plan. And there are certain parameters in there that they need to meet, and one being reducing or managing the amount of soil that erodes off of the landscape. Not every farmer may have fully implemented that or even have one in some cases, and that's one of the challenges that Pennsylvania has had. We created a lot of good rules, never really followed up on them, and that's changing. That's part of that momentum that I was talking about earlier. You know, there's seriousness there in terms of like, hey, guys, you need a plan. We've been talking about it for like 30 years now, and we've had laws for like 30 years now. Well, we need a plan. Let's get a plan. Let's get the technical financial assistance to get that plan done and implemented so that even if you are doing soybeans on that landscape, you're reducing and minimizing or otherwise eliminating the amount of runoff that is polluted runoff coming off of that landscape.
But you know, because you've heard it before, and in most cases, it is a legitimate concern. Farmers will say that, I don't make a lot of money, if I'm making any money at all, and I can't afford to do this or that. Some farmers have taken advantage of money that has come from the government. That was one of the real concerns with maybe that the program going away or the funding for it. But what about that now? I mean, farmers, for the most part, have bought in. Some may be kicking and screaming, but have bought into this, right?
Yes, and that culture of stewardship is strong in much of our agricultural community. And so it's our responsibility, if you will, as a collective, as Pennsylvanians, as legislators, as governors, as regulators and others, to then provide the resources or have the ability to provide the resources so that those farmers who are waiting in line for plans or are under regulatory compliance issues and things of that nature can tap into the resources necessary to actually not only plan but implement those practices. Otherwise, we have a big question to ask is like, and in some cases, you know, is this the type of farm that a farmer that is going to be there for a long period of time, or do we need to look at like different types of ecosystems or economies that can help support that family farmer in Pennsylvania?
Let's take a call from Jim in Edders. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you. I retired from DEP about 5 years ago, and for the 10 years before I retired, I was working with Harry on the Chesapeake, putting in best management practices at farms and at the big hydro plants there. I've been out of touch, and I just wanted to ask him, what's the status of trying to get the eels back into the river that would really help with the water quality?
Thank you very much for your call. The American eel. And why is that important? What's the status, and why is the eel important in the Chesapeake Bay watershed?
Well, migratory fish is a big part of the overall ecosystem, and the small and big dams that have been put in place across the watershed have cut off the ability of not only eels, but shad and other types of fisheries that require or rely on getting out to the Atlantic Ocean and coming back in for their life cycle. It's kind of like the analogous to the salmon situation out in the West. Well, eels... we have these big dams, particularly the three big dams in the lower Susquehanna that produce hydro, one being Conowingo that produces hydroelectric electricity and things of that nature that inhibit that passage, if you will. And while we've had great success in removing smaller dams in much of the watershed, and Pennsylvania included 15 just in the last year or so, those remain, and they have fish ladders that are intended to try to...
They're not really working that well.
But they don't work very well, yeah. Right. And so... In and of themselves, the eels are an important part of the ecosystem, but another thing that a lot of people don't realize is that they actually carry with them, for the lack of a better term, the baby mollusks, the freshwater mollusks that are analogous or the related to, if you want to call it that, in terms of their filtering capacity to the oysters in the Chesapeake Bay. And as a result, our freshwater mussels and snails in our rivers and streams have been depleted, and those are natural filters in the water themselves. Mm. So restoring that fisheries passage as a whole is important, particularly for the eels as well as shad and others.
Hey, Allison, we're almost out of time, and this is a question I'm sure a lot of people have here in Pennsylvania and throughout the region with the weather we've had over the past week. What happens with all the chemicals that we put on the roads, especially salt, when it snows?
I have
about 30 seconds.
Okay. Very common question. There are definitely some that are more environmentally friendly than others. They need to be applied properly. They probably have less of an impact on the bay, more of an impact on your local rivers and streams. So use cautiously and look for alternatives.
Mm. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. There's so many things that we didn't get to, but you can find the barometer, this report, Harry Ware, on your website.
Well, there will certainly be links to it, but also just Google it, Chesapeake Bay Barometer, Chesapeake Bay Program.
Harry Campbell's Executive Director, Chesapeake Bay Foundation, Pennsylvania. Allison Prost, Interim Vice President of Environmental Protection and Restoration for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation and Executive Director, Chesapeake Bay Foundation in Maryland. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott. Have a great one.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, well, we're doing a Smart Talk road trip, and maybe we even talk about some of the same topics we discussed today. We'll be on a Smart Talk road trip at the Pennsylvania State Farm Show. I'll be speaking with Pennsylvania's Secretary of Agriculture, Russell Redding, and a couple other people as well. And maybe we do talk about the Bay on tomorrow's program.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by the team of cardiologists, surgeons, nurses, physicians assistants, and rehabilitation specialists from Pinnacle Health Cardiovascular Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, delivering a broad range of traditional and highly specialized procedures.